From the Passover Haggadah to the Mishnah and Back, an Introduction to Rabbinic Literature with Rabbi Reuven Cohn. Part 1. This recording is copyright by Reuven Cohn and released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, including printed material to follow along with the class, go to www.reuvencohn.com. That's www.reuvencohn.com.
So this is a course about the Haggadah. And in order to do this studying together, we have to make sure that we're all on the same page with regard to some key terms. So I'm going to ask you about the difference between two very key terms. One term is the Seder. We hear people talk about the Passover Seder, right? Or in Boston, we say, well, something. And the other term is the Haggadah. Okay, so anyone, I'd just like to start off with a definition of those two terms.
Well, the Haggadah is the text that we use at the Seder.
Okay, so the Haggadah is a book.
It is a book.
Yeah.
It is a book. And the Seder is the entire event that we have that night.
Okay, so that's interesting. So the Seder is an event, a happening, and that happening has
a book that we could use to guide us.
Okay, so that book is a guide. Is it? Could we call it a script?
We could call it a script.
But you're hesitating.
My father did it as a script.
Which meaning?
We read every word.
We read every word. Okay. And so you prefer to think of it as a guide rather than as a script. Okay, so here's a book. Here's a book called the Haggadah. And we're curious, if you walk into the bookstore and you pick up a book, what drew you to a particular book? Why do you choose this book or that book when you're in a bookstore?
The title, the cover, the author.
Okay, the title, the cover, the author.
Recommendation.
The topic. Okay. So when it's all over, after you've absorbed that book, it's ultimately the content of that book which matters to you. But before you can absorb the content, there's stuff about, you know, as you make your decision as to whether to delve into the book, there are these external signs. Okay, and you mentioned, you check.
The title.
Title. How, you mentioned the cover. How's that for a...
If I were looking at Haggadot, I'd look to see if there was something different about that Haggadah.
Okay, but I'm not talking about Haggadah now, because just the book. So sometimes the cover might tell you how much effort someone put into this book. If they've, but there's of course that cliche, don't judge a book by its cover. So the author, I think, is going to be pretty important when you're choosing a book. Why?
Authors have certain reputations.
Okay. So that having been said, that the author of a book matters to us deeply, and we are sitting studying together because a book called the Haggadah, it's a book, matters to us deeply. So I think we have to think for a moment about who's the author. Who's the author of this book?
The author is anonymous.
Okay. The author is anonymous. So if you were in the bookstore, would that grab you? Author is anonymous? That wouldn't be good enough. Right? So why is that good enough? The author is anonymous. Is there any way that we can penetrate that veil of anonymity?
it's our ancestors. It's people who were trying to carry Judaism along and somehow gathered together to record something that they could pass along. Okay. So there's that Jewish identity.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you're saying we're good without knowing the author because we have some guarantees that this is worthwhile, even the absence of knowledge about the author, that there is some antiquity to this, it's been passed down. Okay, so, yeah?
Its content has been vetted for use. It's not just a book that was from antiquity and buried and discovered.
When you say vetted, I'm not familiar with that term outside of the political process.
I guess just in its usage over the, the hundreds of years, the millennia.
Okay, so you've made a wonderful excuse for the rest of us, because this is actually the first class that I'm teaching in which I started by asking who's the author. Mm-hmm. And I've never been in a class taught by anyone else in which someone says, who's the author? We just don't seem to think about that. With some combination of what the two of you said, it's vetted, it's been around, it's been handed down. Now, does that mean that those of you who said that it's vetted and therefore we're good with it, does that mean that we're stuck with it in the Maxwell House Haggadah form? That it's been vetted, it's from our ancestors, therefore if we change anything, we've lost? Have we backed ourselves into a corner that we don't want to be in? Yeah?
Well, I think John said that one of the reasons he buys a book is recommendations. And clearly, I think this is a book that's been recommended, sometimes with force, and sometimes by invitation, but people have recommended it. And just like any book that's recommended, you then... some of us would say we put our own interpretation on them, although we've all had English teachers who tell us that Shakespeare meant this, and that's it. And I think the same is true here, that some people think that this is immutable, it says what it says, and other people say, no, each person should put themselves into reading the book.
So we actually have a number of different very nice descriptions of what this the power of this authorless book. Okay, but I'm going to go back to that question. I'm still looking for that author. If we can't find an author, can we speak to how old this book is?
Well, portions of it are quite old. There's biblical text. It's a compilation. So someone put it all together. But the oldest parts of it are probably thousands of years old.
Okay. Does anyone else care to comment on that? How old is this? So, now, you have said that parts of it are biblical.
Right.
Now, do we have other circumstances in which we do stuff that's taken from the Bible?
The daily prayer book.
The daily prayer book. So is the Haggadah, what's a part of the daily prayer book that's from the Bible?
All the Psalms.
The Psalms, the Shema, the Va'ahavta. These are taken from the Bible. Does the Haggadah have that? Complete chapters taken from the Bible?
No.
So when we get down to looking at the Haggadah more closely, we're going to have to re-examine exactly what is the relationship of this composed text to the Bible. Okay. So where are we? Yeah.
but we do have long sentences that come directly from the Bible and the story of the outgoing of Egypt, from Egypt.
We have long sentences. Okay.
That are direct quotes.
That are direct quotes. Okay. So we'll be looking at some of those. Now, everyone sitting around the table at this class has in front of them a Haggadah with English translation that I've prepared with numbered sections. Okay? And the numbers are them. There's no commentary, but the numbers themselves are a type of commentary. So I'm actually interested in searching for some of those biblical texts. But before we dive into the Haggadah for a couple of minutes, let me ask you another question. As we sit here together, what part of the Haggadah is your favorite? Or if you're the type of person who might prefer a different question, which part of the Haggadah do you hate the most? Either question. What? And this is really a question about what stands out in your mind with a distance of time.
I always like the Hallel sections.
You always like?
Yeah, the Hallel sections.
That's what I was going to read too.
Yeah,
Hallel
okay.
sections.
So we need a definition of the Hallel section.
Sections.
What's do we have a definition of the Hallel?
Well, if I recall, I think there's two times during.
No, I want a definition
of the Hallel.
What does that word mean for someone?
Songs of praise and
thanks.
I always think of it sort of as gratitude and amazement.
Okay, gratitude, songs of praise, gratitude and amazement. I like that, to God. And why are they called Hallel? Because they are taken from a part of the book of Psalms in which one of the words that has migrated from Hebrew into English is prominent.
Mm-hmm. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Mm-hmm. Glory, glory, hallelujah. So you're remembering Hallel sections in which we're belting out praise to God in with the help of the Bible. Yeah. Anything else? And that's also your favorite. Okay.
I like the story.
Okay. Can you be more specific?
Well, you know, the action, you know. Yeah. So it talks about the fact that we were slaves in Egypt, and then, you know, what happened, and how they went to Egypt, and then they stayed there, and then they were few in number, and
it just goes on and tells the history, the story.
Okay, so the narrative.
The narrative.
The narrative is very compelling.
Well, I don't know if it's compelling. Like a story.
Okay. Yeah. Just because you liked Hallel a moment ago, you can get a second vote.
Okay.
This is like Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah?
The part that I prefer, the starting with the Hallel and all the songs that come subsequently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and all those songs are songs of praise to God also, like Echad Mi Yodea and Kilo Nae, Kilo Yaeh, and the Haggadah, and ultimately they're all about God's power. So
the songs that you mentioned are tacked on at the end,
mm-hmm.
and some of them are folk songs, and those are in fact very recent additions. They're not before about 1500.
Mm-hmm.
So they've only been part of the Seder for 500 years. So we call that recent. Yeah.
One of the things that is so special about the Seders, having done them with extended family year after year after year, is watching the children sort of acclimate and start to look forward to it and learn more of it as the years go on, no matter what their backgrounds are. And to see them as they get, you know, into their college age and older, make every effort that they can to be there, no matter what else is going on in their lives. So it's that's a very special part of what the Seder is.
So if we were to boil down what you just said into one word, children, or maybe generations, handing it off to the next generation. Okay, very interesting.
Or tradition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, this was a very, you know, I'm still interested in whether anyone else has some other part of the Seder that grabs you.
I have another one.
Okay.
I also like, I'm curious if it's a rather new part, which is the Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim part. I like that because for me, given it comes quite near the end of the Seder, for me it validates current history.
Okay. So you use the Hebrew phrase L'Shana Haba'a B'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. which comes at the very end of the Seder, mm-hmm. and that's...
It makes what it all, the chaos that we continue to live with, have a reason.
Anything else?
That's a part that I actually feel uncomfortable with. My father always used to have seders and conclude by saying, next year in New York. And I think that I don't necessarily feel a desire to go to Israel next year myself, except perhaps as a tourist. And I think that concluding with that message kind of distracts me from all of the other positive aspects of the preceding readings and discussion.
Anyone have any thoughts about that?
I feel the same way.
I haven't thought about it, but I think as you mentioned it, I remember always feeling a little bit like weird about that because it's not something that we in our family talk about going to Israel on a regular basis, and we look forward to a trip, but it would certainly be that, a trip.
I can certainly see it provoking tensions within families.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I need to say, as someone whose daughter just made Aliyah a few weeks ago, it for me felt like everything we ever did at the Seder had a purpose.
Well, I have something to say for everybody. Some of you will feel this is good news. Next year in Jerusalem is another one of those recent additions. I'd have to do a little more research to tell you whether it's 500 years old, maybe 700, but it's relatively new. Now,
I just want to elaborate just a bit and tie together what Linda was saying about the family coming together for this. I think the song's in the end because you can really attract children with singing, right. And they can learn words and they can participate in some aspect of the song. I think that unity that is created at the end, everyone's equal singing at the table. It's not dad leading or some grandfather leading and, you know, trying to do things to attract the kids to be interested. Everybody is naturally interested in the family, in song, and the family kind of comes together.
So this is actually quite interesting. The songs that come at the end. Now, you probably have heard that there's discussion among scholars as to whether Jesus' Last Supper was a Passover Seder. And that's a very interesting topic. If his Last Supper was a Seder, that means that's a bonanza for us. Why? That means open up the Gospel, you will find a description of Passover Seder. That is not a recent description. The Gospels were probably written by the year 100, 150. And if you look in the Gospels, in the part which is about the Last Supper, you're told they had their meal and then they went up to the mountain and sang songs of praise to God. Mm-hmm. So exactly the part that several of you have highlighted seems to be a very ancient aspect of the Seder. Now,
So
you know, you asked about the author, and you're asking where pieces or people attributed different pieces to different times. As I think about the Seder, at least as it plays in my mind, I picture Eastern Europe. And many of the songs I picture having been Yiddish songs. The four questions, I can't imagine that those were asked 1,500 years ago. I mean, I think that's probably something, you know, in my mind, it sounds like something out of Eastern Europe. Is that the case? And if so, what are the Sephardim? Is there a God of the same?
So, I need to hold on to something very precious that you just said. I'm holding on to it. You've asked a question. I'm not answering the question just yet. Are you good with that? Okay. And what you said is that the Seder has the aura of Eastern Europe, not just those songs at the end, the Chagadja, but in particular the four questions. It just has the feeling of Eastern Europe, and that's a fascinating comment, but you've already identified a methodology to use to think about this further, is to look into Sephardic customs and practices. Okay, so that you have created a wonderful little agenda item for us, and we'll keep it in mind. Now, let's just, rather than turning the pages of the Haggadah, let's just spend a couple of moments on thinking about, maybe you'll look at it, maybe you might, actually you might do some page flipping. What are the major chunks of the Haggadah? Okay, there is a ditty that many of us sing, Kadesh Borchatz. Now, and the assumption is, that is a medieval ditty. It's wonderful, it's handy. But let's put aside that ditty and think of what are the pieces of the Seder? What are its components? Okay, first piece. What's the first piece of the Seder? Okay. When you say Kadesh, you're thinking about that medieval ditty. What's the usual term? The Kiddush. Okay. So the Seder starts with the Kiddush. Can we have a definition of what Kiddush is?
The introduction, the blessing to start things off.
Is Kiddush a Passover thing?
No.
Okay. So what is it then?
It's basically being thankful for nourishment. I mean, even...
So
it starts off our holiday.
It starts off sacred time. Any event of sacred time is it's liminal. It's the boundary that starts us off in sacred time, and we don't just float in the air. We ground ourselves with wine. And so that is the Kiddush. And so even if we are assembled around a Seder table and we start Kiddush, it feels very Passover. In fact, until with the Kiddush itself is, it could be any holiday, any Friday night. Okay, so that's the Kiddush. What's the next piece?
Washing the hands.
Okay, so the medieval ditty again says that the next phase is washing the hands. That's phase two. That's not much of a phase.
Telling the story.
Nope. No. Not yet. So what I did here is, in the medieval ditty, you have Orchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, and I numbered them together. Orchatz, 2.1, washing, Karpas, 2.2, Yachatz, 2.3. So now my question for you is why I did something. Why did I lump those three stages in the ditty together? I'll tell you part of the answer is because I think all three of these are really one stage.
The symbols?
The symbols. Okay. Can you say more about the symbols? Is there a menorah here? Is there a Jewish star? Is it that type of symbol?
No.
No?
So symbols related to the story that's coming up?
Okay. Yeah, we have one. We have one central symbol of the masa.
Okay. So these are certain, it's excellent to point out that this is a time for symbols, but the symbols are all about food, right? Mm-hmm. It's food as symbol. Do we get to eat this food? That's the downside of food as symbol. It is, so I like to call this section two of the Seder symbolic involvement with food. Okay, you do get to eat a little something. You dip the vegetable. How many people use parsley? Okay, any potato
mixed
people?
Yeah, we used to do potato.
Okay, so I
argue every year.
My family is potato, and I still remember in the kindergarten, Mrs. Wogmuth had a model Seder, and we were doing this stuff, and she brought this ridiculous green stuff, which I couldn't imagine how Mrs. Wogmuth, such a shining authority figure, could have gotten it so terribly wrong. So symbolic involvement with food, what does that do for us?
Well, if it's a potato, it's more than symbolic. I mean, I thought the tradition around the potato was that it got you through the early part of the Seder in middle shape.
So does this symbolic involvement with food do anything for you?
Sure. It sort of sanctifies food. I mean, it makes us think about the importance of food and, you know,
when you treat food as symbols, you're starting to transform the meal that's coming up into something other than just stuffing of the face. So Kiddush, crossing the boundary into sacred time, and then symbolic involvement with food. Okay, and then what?
And then the story.
Okay, then the story. Now, let's go back to the medieval ditty. The name of the name given in the ditty for the story?
Magid.
Related to the word Haggadah, to tell. Now, we'll have a little break. And after the break, we will chop up the story into its pieces.